Chapman Partnership provides more than just food and shelter for the homeless. They are committed to making the homeless whole again. From treatment for medical, dental, and mental health issues to vocational training to child care and housing placement, Chapman Partnership guides the homeless from hopelessness to self-sufficiency, having served over 90,000 people with a success rate upwards of 62%. You can help the homeless with your support for Chapman Partnership. Details at 877-548-6369 or chapmanpartnership.org.
And we return. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, happy Election Day.
Yes, today's the day.
I just had a report from our regular contributor, Dan Ricker, who says he's been monitoring precincts in Miami-Dade County, and he says the lines are quite short. And also our producer, Richard Ives, voted this morning in Broward and said it was a breeze. So if the early voting lines kept you away, give it another shot today.
Right. Although there have been, I saw some lines this morning on the way to work, but that's probably people who were going before, you know, wanted to vote before work.
Right.
That was quite early.
Well, for decades, Americans have been prodded, exhorted, encouraged, and urged to vote. But in the past year, many roadblocks have sprung up, especially in Florida. Joining us now is attorney and voting expert Victoria Bassetti. She's the author of Electoral Dysfunction, a Survival Manual for American Voters. And she joins us from New York City. Welcome to you, Victoria Bassetti.
Thanks. Good morning and happy Election Day to everyone.
You too. Let's start with the basic. Do Americans have the right to vote?
Well, I don't think anyone would say that we're not a democracy, but by the same token, the right to vote actually isn't written into our Constitution. It wasn't when it was first drafted in 1787, and it still doesn't exist to this day on a federal level. There have been a lot of constitutional amendments that have been passed since 1787, which kind of nose around the question of a right to vote. The 15th Amendment being the most notable one, passed in the wake of the Civil War, which provided that the right to vote can't be denied on the basis of race. But if state and county election officials can come up with cleverer ways to keep people from voting, the Constitution pretty much lets them do it. Now, on a state-by-state basis, a lot of people do have the right to vote because the state constitution has created a right to vote. States like Wisconsin and Missouri have an explicit right to vote in their constitution, but states like Indiana and Georgia do not.
Do you think there's any chance of the Constitution ever being amended to include the right to vote? I mean, have there been efforts over time?
You know, there's a constitutional amendment that's been pending in the Congress since 2001, and it's never really gotten a terrific amount of momentum. Amending the Constitution, as you might imagine, is very hard, although amending the Constitution to deal with voting is one of those frequent things that we do. I personally, and this is just my personal opinion, think that the odds of getting a constitutional amendment to get a right to vote are very slim. Although I do, by the same token, think that it's terribly needed.
Is Florida's reduced early voting dates and the recent crackdown on registration drives the most far-reaching in the country?
You know, Florida and Ohio are sort of vying with each other right now for some of the more far-reaching efforts. And, you know, Florida, as many of your listeners know, both reduced early voting hours, also has been conducting a fair number of registration purges of registration rolls, and in addition restricted the ability of but imposed new requirements on third-party voter registration groups that caused many of them to pull out of the state, although they subsequently went back in after winning a lawsuit. Ohio has been doing slightly different things, but also relating to voter registration purges and early voting. And meanwhile, other states have attacked the issue of voting, if you want to call it that, by imposing strict voter ID requirements or other sort of inhibiting efforts. But I would say Florida has definitely, in the course of the last few years, been among the more aggressive in terms of let's say, going after voting.
We're speaking with Victoria Bassetti. She's the author of Electoral Dysfunction, a Survival Manual for American Voters. If you'd like to join in the conversation, did long early voting lines or other ID factors keep you from voting, please call in and join the conversation at 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email to join in at radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. So there are 13,000 voting districts, each with their own rules and regulations. Why isn't this nationalized so that we have universal voter registration?
You know, that goes all the way back once again to 1787, when the founders were drafting the Constitution, and when they didn't put a right to vote in the Constitution. One of the things that they did is devolve election administration to the states and local governments. They did that in part as a necessary compromise. You know, who were they to tell, South Carolina that they had to let African Americans or slaves vote? Or in the alternative, tell Massachusetts, where former slaves and African Americans were allowed to vote, that those rules would be repealed. So it was a kind of a necessary compromise in the 18th century to get the Constitution adopted. It was too hard to impose universal rules on each individual state. It probably would have fractured the compromise that led to the adoption of the Constitution. Mm. In the intervening years, we've really kind of stuck with that compromise, which is letting states create the rules and regulations surrounding voting and voter eligibility. There have been a few notable exceptions, and most of them have come in the last 50 or 60 years. The Voting Rights of 1965 really kind of took a strong, hard look at a lot of our voting laws and imposed a lot of requirements on states. And then the National Voter Registration Act of 1993, which is the motor voter law, imposed certain requirements regarding registration, and then in the wake of 2000, the Help America Vote Act also imposed some requirements and attempted to create some uniform federal requirements. But it's always been very piecemeal. It's never been systematically looked at, and we've certainly never put any kind of concentrated federal money or efforts into creating uniform standards. I think it's because a lot of people are very protective of their state and local prerogatives in the way that they've always done it, and they are also dubious of whether or not we could effectively impose uniform federal requirements.
Victoria, how about the legality of photo ID laws? You can certainly still be a citizen without a driver's license or a passport.
Yeah, in fact, you know, most estimates are that 10% of the country nationwide, of eligible voters nationwide, lack current government-issued photo identification. When you break it down into particular demographic groups, those numbers soar. There are some estimates that as much as 25% of the African-American population lacks current valid government-issued photo identification. Even the same sort of numbers when you talk about kids between the ages of 18 and 30. A lot of kids today don't drive. They use public transportation, so they don't go get driver's licenses. So when you impose photo identification requirements, you really put very large and important segments of our population at risk of not being able to vote. And you're doing that in order to solve a problem that actually doesn't seem to exist. Every systematic, rigorous, academic or journalistic look into the existence of in-person voter impersonation shows that there's absolutely no significant problem in that area. Nevertheless, when the U.S. Supreme Court took up the issue in 2006, regarding an Indiana voter identification law, the U.S. Supreme Court said that it was constitutional under federal law, and that goes back to us not having a federal right to vote. In contrast, in Missouri, where they do have a right to vote written into their constitution, the Missouri Supreme Court promptly struck down a photo identification law in that state. So that kind of really demonstrates the patchwork quilt, kind of strange nature of laws regarding voting in the United States, where it could be constitutional under federal law, but not constitutional under state law.
One thing I didn't understand, why do, is this across the board, why do mailed absentee ballots require no ID, whereas if you submit one in person, your ID is required? Is that in every state?
That varies on a state-by-state basis, and it has to do with how the state has implemented their laws and requirements regarding absentee ballots. And actually, that's something that's in some states are tightening up. You know, they are requiring stricter rules regarding identification for absentee ballots. But it's sort of difficult, you know, to like ask someone to photocopy their ID with their absentee ballot and match their signature. So it's pretty rough to do it with an absentee ballot.
What are these provisional ballots, and are they assured of being counted or not?
So provisional ballots are kind of the fail-safe, if you will. They were they had been used throughout the United States, you know, starting probably in the early 90s or late 1980s. But after 2000, when there was so much reporting of people being turned away from the polls and not given any opportunity to salvage their vote, the federal government, when it passed the Help America Vote Act, required that provisional ballots be given out by every state. And so a provisional ballot is supposed to be given to you under any set of exceptional circumstances where you get to the poll and for some reason or another you can't vote. So if you don't have photo ID in one of the states that do require photo ID, they're supposed to give you a provisional ballot. If for some reason or another your name is not on the voter registration rolls, they're supposed to give you a ballot. If you've shown up in the wrong precinct, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see there are a lot of reasons why a provisional ballot is an attempt to salvage. It's that last gasp effort to get you to be able to vote. Now, what's interesting about it is that the use of provisional ballots is really diffuse and diverse across the country. There's some states where provisional ballots are rather freely given out if a voter has a problem. You know, there's a problem, so there's like, well, let's give you a provisional ballot. Come on, let's try to make it work. And then those states also tend to count the provisional ballots very generously. You know, they make a real effort. There are other states where they're really tight with their provisional ballots. You know, you almost have to fight to get one from the poll worker. And even after you get one, you have to fight to get it counted. So even though we kind of attempted to impose this federal uniformity around provisional ballots in the Help America Vote Act, which is everyone has to use them, we've never really kind of established terribly good standards for when those provisional ballots will be counted and how easily they'll be given out. There's a huge controversy going on right now in Ohio regarding the use of provisional ballots, and Ohio has always had, you know, kind of controversies regarding the use of provisional ballots. There's a problem in Ohio known as right church, wrong pew, which is basically in Ohio they won't count your provisional ballot unless you cast your provisional ballot in your actual voting precinct. And what's happened in a lot of cases is people have gone into polling stations, they've been misdirected to the wrong precinct, they have a kind of a discussion there and are given a provisional ballot at that wrong precinct, and then they cast their provisional ballot and it's ruled ineligible. And it turns out if they'd literally gone one desk over or two desks over to the right precinct, they would have been able to vote. Mm-hmm. But Ohio nevertheless throws out those ballots. Big fight going on about that right now.
We're speaking with Victoria Bassetti, the author of Electoral Dysfunction. Victoria, stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. You can also stream us online at WLRN.org. The New World Symphony, America's Orchestral Academy, presents a wall cast concert with music of Mendelssohn and Prokofiev Saturday, November 10th at 7:30 p.m., free at Miami Beach Soundscape. Details at nws.edu. The disease of addiction doesn't discriminate based on age or status. Comprehensive addiction treatment and recovery offered for older adults and baby boomers at Hanley Center. 855-718-2233. Hanley Center. Recovery for life.
Like Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. And we're speaking with Victoria Bassetti. She's an expert on electoral processes, and we're getting to the ins and outs of voting. Victoria, there's a lot of ballyhoo about undocumented persons somehow committing voter fraud. I just don't understand why any undocumented person would take the chance of discovery and arrest to vote.
Yeah, I don't either. I think there definitely have been very small numbers of instances of people who are not citizens voting. It tends to be a genuine mistake on their part, a genuine belief on their part that they were eligible to vote, and not an effort to, you know, manipulate or change the vote. It tends to occur when it does because, as I mentioned, when you get a driver's license, you're also often prompted at the government agency to register to vote at the time that you get your driver's license. And so many non-citizens, they're legal, in many cases legal, residents of the United States, but they're not citizens. Upon being offered the opportunity to register to vote at the motor vehicle agency, register to vote, not realizing at that moment in time, oh, wait a second, I'm not eligible to vote. It's not a huge number of people, but there's some people who just, you know, they just made the mistake, you know, and then they get caught up in election fever and they vote. They're excited about it. Most of them are not, you know, kind of attempting to do anything awful. It's, and again, to reiterate, it's exceptionally low numbers of people, possibly, you know, 100. In the state of Florida, you know, so it's a very low number, but that's how the honest mistake tends to get made.
So what did you discover in your research about who does and who does not vote? Do you have that as a gender breakdown? What are your findings?
Yeah, when you look at the demographics of people voting, it's very interesting. For example, women vote at much higher levels than men do, notably, and so when people talk about the gender gap, they can be talking about it in two ways. The first is women just vote more than men. I'm not going to get my numbers right, but you know, if 70% of the eligible male population votes, it's more like 78% of the female eligible population votes. Those numbers aren't exactly right, so don't hold me to it. And then, as many people also know, there's also another gender gap or gender break where women disproportionately are supporting Barack Obama this election versus men supporting Mitt Romney. But there are many other sort of disparate groups in terms of the way people vote. For example, Latinos don't vote at nearly the rate as whites do. Younger people also do not vote at nearly the rate as older people do. Richer people also vote more than poorer people do. One of the demographic groups that's got amongst the lowest turnout rates in the United States are young Latinos at this stage of the game. And I think that's very worrying to a lot of people who believe strongly in voting and who believe strongly that having people from every walk of life vote is important to a representative democracy.
We have a couple of callers we can go to. This is Betya in Miami. Hello there.
Yes, hi.
Go ahead.
Can I ask? I have a question. Who are the electorate? And who are those people? How do they appoint it? Or we are voting for them? Or how do they get to be electorate? And why they were chosen to vote for me for the president?
Yeah,
the Electoral College.
The Electoral, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Just maybe to remind your listeners, as many people probably do know, when you vote today for president, you're not actually voting for president. You're voting for someone to vote for president.
Yes.
And that's the Electoral College, which will meet in early December, and there are 538 members of the Electoral College. Each state
and who are they?
Yes, exactly. So each state selects its electors differently. In fact, under the Constitution, the state of Florida, if they felt like it, could have a lottery for who their electors are. They could just, or the governor could pick up the phone book and just kind of tap out names out of the phone book. It's literally unregulated the way a state can or cannot select its electors. Now, as it happens, most states don't do anything as silly as a lottery or picking names out of a phone book. What they do is, and this is not every state, but it's most of the states, what they do is they allow the state Democratic and Republican Party, or Green Party, or Independent Party, or whichever party it happens to be, to select the electors. And for example, in the state where I am right now, in New York, the New York State Democratic Party appoints its electors for New York State. The people that they select as electors are party activists, but they don't tend to be high-ranking party activists. In other words, your senator or your state representative, they tend to be, let's say, a local county party chairman or party secretary at some particular local county. They attempt in selecting the electors to be demographically diverse and ethnically diverse, et cetera, but they are ultimately just selected by, you know, by whoever runs the party in your state.
So there's one person for every vote?
No. For example, in New York, I think we've got 29 electoral college votes. So there are 29 electors who are selected.
So I think maybe what Betty is asking, and my question as well, is what qualifications must an elector have?
The qualifications that an elector must have are determined kind of at will by the state Democratic or Republican parties who pick the electors. There are no actual requirements other than what the state parties themselves may determine.
Will the restrictions instituted by the states in the last year have any effect on the Electoral College? Could it? Are they the strictest in the swing states as well, say Florida, Ohio, Virginia, and such?
To go back, by the way, to that previous question again about the now each in most states, though not all states, the electors are committed to voting for whoever wins the popular vote in their state. So, you don't have, you usually don't have someone who just kind of willy-nilly changes their vote because they feel like it. Although, incidentally, it was quite different in the 19th century. You were asking about state efforts to change the Electoral College, and there's an initiative underway called this National Popular Vote, which attempts to undo the Electoral College and the effects of it, and it would, as may have been clear, or maybe not in that last answer, one of the kind of perverse effects of the Electoral College is that there are situations in the United States, and it's happened four times in history, where the person who wins the overall national popular vote has actually not become president because of the way the Electoral College votes, and that's why you hear so many people talking about swing states at this stage of the game. So this National Popular Vote initiative, which is underway, currently is halfway towards the mark of eliminating the effects of the Electoral College. Briefly, what it does is it's a compact, an interstate compact, where every state that signs that compact commits to giving its Electoral College votes to the winner of the national vote, not the winner of the particular state's vote. Once enough states who cumulatively have 270 Electoral College votes between them have signed on to the compact, then it would go into effect, at which point, basically, whoever wins the national vote wins the presidency, regardless of, kind of the arcane workings of the Electoral College. But not a single swing state yet has signed on to this compact.
So that would avoid the rigors of a constitutional amendment to void the Electoral College.
Exactly, it would. And it goes back to that point I was making about how each state is allowed to select its electors however it wants. Not only is it allowed to select its electors however it wants, it's allowed to allocate its electors however it wants. So today, every state virtually, there are two exceptions, every state allocates its electoral college votes on a winner-take-all basis. Whoever wins Florida's popular vote gets all of Florida's electoral college votes. It's conceivable, of course, that Florida or any state could split them up. And historically, that's exactly what did happen in the early 19th century. But in the last 150 or 160 years, it's been a winner-take-all approach to the Electoral College.
Do you expect election results today to be contested in some states?
I think it's inevitable. Mm. Absolutely. I think, you know, even if it's not, even if you know, your listeners may have heard this before. It's oft repeated. There's the election administrator's prayer, which is, please God, don't let it be close.
Right.
So even if, and there's no telling right now what's going to happen on the presidential election today. Let's say it's not close, but guaranteed there are going to be some close Senate elections. There are going to be a lot of close House elections. There will be close gubernatorial elections. There are going to be a lot of other close elections. And, you know, basically each party and our entire election administration system is basically an armed camp bristling with lawyers ready to file lawsuits in an instant. So maybe we'll avoid major lawsuits surrounding the presidential election. We certainly will not avoid presidential lawsuits. We certainly will not avoid lawsuits surrounding other elections that are going on today.
Would you expect by morning in the presidential side that we'd have a clear winner if it's close?
You know, there's no telling. And again, since everyone is sort of projecting at this stage of the game that it all comes down to Ohio, you know, there could be a lot going on in Ohio that we're not going to be able to understand by the end of tonight, or there's no saying. Again, if it's not close, we'll know tonight.
Well, you were saying there are so many problems in Ohio with the provisional ballots already, so that just kind of seems like it's going to present some problems.
Yeah, one of the key questions that people kind of need to be looking for tonight, and this is going to be a hard piece of data to get, but it's going to be an important piece of data, which is how many provisional ballots were cast in Ohio. You also need to ask that in Pennsylvania, but Ohio is probably going to be the bigger state to be looking at. So if, you know, more than, say, 0.5% of the overall number of ballots cast were provisional ballots, that would be a very high number, but if it were, then you might see the count in Ohio drag out for a very, very long time.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, we're speaking with Victoria Bassetti. She's the author of Electoral Dysfunction. That number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, that's radio@wlrn.org, and Bonnie will take those. Bob in Dania Beach. Hello, Bob.
Hi. I just want to commend the author for the very clever title of Electoral Dysfunction. But it seems to me that a lot of us are just don't even want to bother to vote when it's just routinely over and over again. There's so much fraud and computer hacking, so that all this discussion, sadly, today and coverage throughout the year, throughout the campaigns, no one's discussing the lack of true, transparent accountability and the counting process, because all these little details about voting early or in writing or all the stuff is moot when the computers are actually the ones that who's ever flipping the switches, let's say. And you can just go on YouTube for all kinds of documentation of fraud that's even current, not just 4 or 8 years ago. I'm talking about even GOP versus GOP frauds and tricks and sneaky things, and it's at the digital level.
So, you know, I hearing something like that makes me a little bit sad, because I'm a kind of a real optimist about voting. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, for all your despair or the despair that many voters might feel about these sort of issues, at the end of the day, voting is our power. It's each of our individual's ultimate act of citizenship, and it's kind of lighting a match in the room and kind of putting your mark on history.
In theory, yes, but if the voters are not being counted, if there's no transparent accountability that it is, then where's this privilege mean? Nothing.
Well, I understand your feeling about that, but I would add, first of all, that there are plenty of stories out there of bad things happening, but I would caution that the vast majority of elections and voters on election day have a good experience and their votes do get counted. And I would also say that, you know, one of the reforms that's happened in the United States over the course of the last 60 years has been a lot of really rigorous analysis of the way we vote. Almost every election board has got multiple observers. There are many people in the room watching what's going on. There are a lot of people out there looking and catching these sort of problems. There are huge penalties and prison time that are attached to these sort of things. There will always be devils and miscreants who are going to be out there trying to steal and manipulate the election, but we catch them more often than not, and the vast majority of time your vote does count and it does matter. And it's really important for people to understand that that they should get out there and vote. Let me also add that that your feeling about these sort of issues can be channeled into an important demand that your vote should count. You know, one of the ironies, of course, is that voting is the solution to all of our voting problems. And if people feel kind of frustrated about our voting system, they ultimately do have the power to change it. We have passed major legislation before that's reformed the way our voting is conducted, and we can do it again.
Why do you think it is that we still don't have one national ballot design for the entire country, like in Canada?
Oh, God, I wish we did. You know, I'm sure, I looked at my ballot this morning. It was a mess. It was multiple fonts. It was hard to read. It was such a mess, and it was totally confusing. I had one opportunity on my ballot to vote three times for the same person. It was ridiculous. The short answer is because imposing with 13,000 election districts in the United States, many of which have their own different machines that they use, many of which you can imagine straight off the bat the difficulty of trying to impose a uniform ballot for 13,000 different election districts and hundreds of different types of machines, combined with the fact that, you know, every election district has got different things on the ballot, right?
Right.
So it's from what I understand, in parts of Florida today, you've got 10-page ballots.
We have 5 pages both sides.
Yeah, exactly.
We have 11 constitutional amendments, which were created by the legislature, which isn't restricted as far as the verbiage length.
Exactly. So you can see how there are just sort of these logistical difficulties of kind of creating a uniform national ballot. Now, that being said, there's no reason why we shouldn't take a real stab at least imposing some, you know, kind of minimum level of standards, or maybe 5 or 6 different standards that could be adhered to depending on the type of machine or the type of ballot that's being created. I don't know if we can, like I said, create a uniform national ballot, but boy, it is definitely one of those things that we need to tackle because so many votes are lost and so many people are confused because of poor ballot design. It's really a terrible shame.
Well, look what happened in 2000 in Florida with the ballot.
That's the most prominent example of it, but it's not the only one. I feel like I'm kind of going back to that gentleman who called before who was so despairing of the system, and we're sort of feeding his despair. I hope rather than feeding despair and feeling of not voting, what we should be feeding is a real fire for people to go fix it, you know, and make sure that their vote does count.
So how do we fix it? I mean, what can we do as citizens to fix it?
Well, you know, I think...
Other than vote, of course.
Yeah, you know, if I had, you know, kind of my way, there are a few things that I would do. The first thing, and possibly the most important, is to slowly but surely attempt to kind of get the partisanship out of the system. We have an election administration system that's by and large run by partisans, not in every state. There are some real notable exceptions, states where the way that their elections are run are truly by a nonpartisan manner. And Canada, by the way, is also run on a nonpartisan manner. That means, you know, setting up kind of almost like a Federal Reserve Board for voting, right, on a federal as well as on a state-by-state vote level, you know, where you've got people who run the election system who have got long terms, who are appointed on a bipartisan or a nonpartisan basis, and they are stewards, guardians of the people's vote, first and foremost. They're not Democrats or Republicans. Might take a little bit of time to do, but I think that's something that we ought to all aim for. And then the next thing I would do is, you know, one of the great things about the kind of living in the information era is the vast amount of information that's now being collected on how our voting systems run. We know a lot. We've got a lot of, you know, kind of metrics out there to say this system is good, that system is bad, or these numbers are good or these numbers are bad. I think that, you know, we could establish some clear deliverables and some clear metrics that we could measure every election district against one another on. And that would really help people demand better performance from voting administration. We could create almost a democracy scorecard so that everyone knows how well is their vote being counted, how well is the voting, our voting mechanics being administered. If we could do those two things, and we can, but if we could do those two things, I think we would see a real kind of boost in public confidence about the way our elections are administered. And once you see that, you'd see more people voting, too. It would be a virtuous cycle, you know?
Right. Do you think that's one of the reasons the U.S. ranks near the bottom of industrialized democracies and voter registration?
I think it does. I think, we've got an antiquated system, we've got convoluted laws, and we just, you know, we don't make it easy for people to vote. You know, if American businesses ran their customer service systems the way our election administration system runs voting, our economy would be in really bad shape, and it would be in permanently bad shape.
Right. We're speaking with Victoria Bassetti. She's the author of Electoral Dysfunction, a Survival Manual for American Voters on today's Topical Currents. You can join in the conversation at 1-800-743-9576. Stay with us, Victoria. We need to take one more short break, and we'll be right back.
And we'll be back to Topical Currents in just a moment right here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. The Bill Cosford Cinema at the University of Miami presents Nobody Walks. Called evocative by The Village Voice, the story follows a family's surge of emotions and desire brought to the surface by their house guest. Showtimes and more details at cosfordcinema.com. City Year Miami unites a diverse group of 17 to 24-year-olds for a year of service as tutors, mentors, and role models who make a difference to students and schools. You can learn more online at cityyear.org. City Year. Give a year. Change the world.
All over the nation, people are stepping up for their friends and loved ones by taking part in Alzheimer's Association's Walk to End Alzheimer's, a disease that affects 5.4 million Americans and is the sixth leading cause of death in the nation. This year, the direct cost to the nation for caring for those with Alzheimer's totals an estimated $200 billion. You can do your part to find a cure when you walk in Broward on Saturday, November 10th. Registration details at alz.org/walk or 800-272-3900. Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Join us for Wednesday's Topical Currents and a discussion with financial reporter Chrystia Freeland of Reuters. She's the author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. There's always been a wide gap between rich and poor, but in the past few decades, what it means to be rich has changed dramatically. Listen in to Topical Currents Wednesday at 1 o'clock.
And we are back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We're discussing Electoral Dysfunction. It's a book by Victoria Bassetti. Victoria, how about a website where people could learn more about the book and about you?
Sure, it's www.electoraldysfunction, all one word, .org.
And I just want to add, there's also a film which I watched with narrated and with Mo Rocca called Electoral Dysfunction.
And it's on iTunes now, right?
It is.
It was on PBS.
It was on PBS. It may be airing a little few other times, and viewers can actually, or listeners can check our website to see if it's still available. I doubt it, but it's definitely available on iTunes right now.
It's very entertaining.
It is. It's Mo Rocca is funny and charming.
Of course, yes. He's on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Yeah.
Let's take a call or two. This is Oria. He or she's been waiting quite a bit. Thanks for your patience, Oria. Hi.
Not a problem. Victoria, I have a couple questions and comments. And
how about starting with one?
Okay, well, we can start with one. So my first comment is that I'm a 27-year-old small businessman. I live in downtown Miami. And when I went to the polling station today, it was a two-hour line. Now, because of the fact that I own my own small business, if I don't work, I don't get paid. So if I have a choice between waiting 2 hours in line to vote and going to the office and working with my employees, it's almost a no-brainer. That being said, I guess my question to you is there any data that talks or discusses how many people don't vote as a result of, more important things, or them having to take care of, certain business aspects in their life? I'm not exactly sure if I'll be able to make it back to the polls. And I'm wondering if there's a larger group of people that this happens to as well.
Yes, there is a quite a bit of data kind of looking into these issues, and what you mentioned, not enough time or kind of polling hours are inadequate or inconvenient is regularly the number one reason why people mention that they don't vote. It's a problem that affects millions and millions of voters every year who face these long lines or who have to deal with the fact that the polls are only open, say, from 8 a.m. till 6 p.m., and that's exactly when they work. It's a large part of the reason why early voting hours and no excuse absentee ballots have really surged in use in the United States over the course of the last decade. I think you've probably heard that estimates are that as much as 35% to 40% of the votes in the current presidential election have already been cast, either through absentee mail-in or early voting hours. The problem that you mentioned about the long lines is an intractable and difficult one for election administrators to deal with. They struggle mightily to avoid those lines, usually. Obviously, we've all heard of instances where we believe that those lines were kind of intentionally caused, but in general, voting administrators don't like seeing those lines. They have the problem, of course, of surge and peak voting hours, where people all come in all at once, and then if you were to come back an hour and a half later, there'd be one person straggling in line. It's a very difficult thing to deal with administratively.
Do you think that President Obama's election in 2008 caused effects on voter ID laws and other ballot security measures?
I don't know if it was his election per se. I think I definitely think that one of the things that's happened is a kind of an increasing, I'm going to say this ironically, scientific rigor that has been brought to bear on the issues of voting, for good and ill. And one of those pieces of scientific rigor means that it's not hard for partisans with spreadsheets to kind of take a look at how they might be able to depress or suppress turnout amongst particular demographic groups and therefore to swing an election one way or another. It's the same sort of thinking that kind of is brought to bear on redistricting pretty often. So I think that, that's one of those skill sets that's really evolved over the course, and I use the word skill set a little ironically, it's one of those skill sets that's evolved in the course of the last 7 years. And so these increasingly sophisticated suppression techniques are being brought to bear on particular groups and particular demographics.
Mm. We have an emailer, Paul and Davey. He says he's never had anything good to say about the Electoral College. However, with the hurricane hitting the Northeast, liberal turnout may be suppressed. Those people will still have their votes count in proportion to their state's population.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. It's you know, a lot of people have concerns about the whole idea of a national popular vote. The effects of a natural disaster, I don't think were on people's list beforehand, but they may well be afterwards.
Right.
But you're right. You know, one of the reasons why people are often very nervous about a national popular vote for president is how do you do a recount in that situation? You know, right now we can do recounts on a statewide basis or even on a countywide basis if necessary for a presidential election, but the prospect of having to do a full national recount really terrifies people. You know, I personally think that's a logistical problem that we can deal with, and it's no reason to throw principles to the wind, the principle being that the person with the most votes should win.
We only have a few minutes left, Victoria Bassetti. I suppose it would be a technical nightmare, but is there any possibility in the future of having online voting?
I'm kind of a little bit of an optimist on this, and I don't have a lot of friends in this camp, but I do believe that there will come a day when online voting is going to be possible. I think there's a lot of thinking and work that needs to be done between now and then, so I don't see it happening, you know, in the next decade, but I think that there's going to come a time when online voting absolutely will occur. There are a lot of security and verification issues that need to be resolved, but I do believe that it can be done with a will. And, of course, an important thing around online voting that we need to consider is how to deal with the real digital divide in the country, where there are substantial numbers of people who don't have high-speed internet connections.
Right.
And, you know, we would have to create online voting that would really be accessible to everyone. So that's part of the thinking that needs to go into it. But I think there will come a day when that's a distinct possibility. Although I also think there's a real chance that a lot of people are never going to walk away from paper balloting. They really like those.
Do you think the Supreme Court has played a role in electoral dysfunction?
Absolutely. I think that they have created a kind of a real patchwork quilt of laws regarding how and whether something is or is not constitutional regarding elections, you know, not just in Bush v. Gore and in the case surrounding Indiana voter ID. If you were to bring a kind of a constitutional challenge to something regarding election administration, you would be judged on what the Supreme Court deems a quote-unquote flexible standard. There's no clear guidelines provided by the Supreme Court on a lot of the ways that we administer our elections. Now, it's not just the Supreme Court's fault. You know, there are a lot of institutions out there who have really kind of added to the overall muddle surrounding election law.
Right.
Once again, Victoria Bassetti, how about the website where people can learn more about you and also the video?
Yeah, it's electoraldysfunction.org, O-R-G. And I think people will be able to, you know, kind of learn about the movie and the book there and kind of learn a little bit about why, you know, I think those of us who made the movie really think that we need a strongly informed citizenry that's committed to changing and reforming the way we conduct our elections.
How many eligible citizens vote in presidential elections?
So the last election in 2008 was a high watermark. It was approximately 62% of the eligible population voted for president. When you get down to other elections, not presidential elections, in an off year, just a congressional election year, turnout tends to fall below 40, tends to be around 40%. If you go to city or state or gubernatorial elections, non-federal elections, turnout can be even lower. Mm. Last year, for the Houston mayoral election, the turnout was, I think, something on the order of 8%.
My.
Victoria Bassetti, it's been a very pleasurable hour. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
She's the author of Electoral Dysfunction, A Survival Manual for American Voters. Thank you very much, Victoria.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. It was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance as well. Remember, we'll have complete election coverage beginning tonight at 7 from WLRN, Miami Herald News. We also have free audio archives and downloads at our new website, WLRN.org. Also, author and book links such as today's at the Topical Currents Facebook page. There's also staff photos, discussion, and more. Tomorrow's program is with acclaimed financial reporter Christia Freeland. She's written Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Rich, and The Fall of Everyone Else. Now a wide-ranging calendar. On this day in 1917, 95 years ago, the Bolshevik coup d'etat begins with the capture of the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, Russia. Also on this day in 1962, after losing his second election in a row, this one to Pat Brown for the governorship of California, Richard Nixon gives a concession speech and retires from public life. Well, for a while. One more while we recall anarchy in the UK. On this day, 1975, the Sex Pistols, the pioneer punk band, plays their first gig at St. Martin's School of Art in London. The originals were Johnny Rotten, Steve Jones, Paul Cook, and bassist Glenn Matlock. Sid Vicious would replace Matlock in early 1977. Best known for their single God Save the Queen, the Pistols blew off their induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Again, election coverage tonight at 7 from WLRN, Miami Herald News. And we leave with the 1962 conclusion of Nixon's concession speech. But as I leave, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore, because gentlemen, this is my last press conference. This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is